everyone. Welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 10th of May with me, Ian Welsh. Coming up is the usual digest of some of what's been happening in the sustainable business world. And while he was in New York last week, Innovation Forum's Toby Webb met up with Tonsi Whelan, Professor of Business and Society at the Stern School of Business and the former president of the Rainforest Alliance. They talk about how business leaders can embed sustainability in their companies to lead innovation and drive productivity. It's very much worth a listen. All that a bit later on, but first is our weekly roundup of what's been happening in business and sustainability. Could ecosystem destruction be the new climate change? This week's UN Global Assessment Report on Catastrophic Biodiversity Loss reveals that over a million species on the planet are at risk of extinction, with around half of natural ecosystems already lost. The biomass of wild animals has fallen by 82% as a result of human activity, the report says. With contributions from 450 scientists and experts and taking 3 years to complete, other report headlines include that 2 in 5 amphibians are at risk of extinction, as well as nearly one third of all marine species. Insects too are under threat, with 1 in 10 critically threatened. Here, there is a direct link to economics, of course, with $577 billion of agricultural output under threat through lack of pollinators. Overall, the report paints a picture of overexploitation of the planet's finite resources on a grand scale, alongside discharging of untreated and toxic wastes at levels way beyond nature's capacity to absorb. Sobering stuff indeed, and businesses will ignore species extinction risks at their peril, as for climate change and other environmental impacts. There is some better news, not least that the consensus necessary for the conflict-averse UN to make such strong statements has already been reached. Biodiversity loss is now an issue on the agenda for discussion at the G8, and the UK government has commissioned a new report from Cambridge University academics on the economic case for nature along the lines of the Stern report into climate change. And in the wake of the UK's Committee on Climate Change's report into the country's potential zero emissions future last week, the UK Parliament, taking time out from hand-wringing over Brexit, became the first national legislature to declare a climate emergency. The motion, proposed by the Labour opposition, was unopposed by the government, with the Environment Secretary Michael Gove reiterating his view that climate change is a crisis that we all have to meet. Also in the UK, luxury retailer Selfridges has announced that it has entirely eliminated palm oil from the supply chains of its own brand foods, a feat it has managed 9 months ahead of its self-imposed deadline. Selfridges' view is that consumers don't want products that contain palm oil, given its links to deforestation in Southeast Asia, and hence also climate change. The Roundtable for Sustainable Palm Oil says that certified no deforestation palm oil is the way to go. Others argue the case for sustainable palm oil's use, given it is a more efficient, lower impact crop than the alternative oils that are now in Selfridges' supply chain. Water use is a key challenge in many supply chains, and AB Sugar has announced a new partnership with WaterAid and Cambridge University to encourage innovation to address water loss in agriculture, particularly in sugar production. Entries in the Innovate Irrigation Challenge will be assessed by a panel of judges, with the winning concepts potentially set to be launched by AB Sugar and partners. Responding to a consultation review from the Principles for Responsible Investment, the group managing Norway's €909 billion sovereign wealth fund has argued that investors should not be assessed for outcomes in line with the Sustainable Development Goals. The Norwegian group says that it is difficult to measure an investor's direct impact on the SDGs, particularly in the case of minority investors. The PRI wants to oblige its signatories to report how they have considered climate change risks in their portfolios from 2020 and is surveying them now for views on the best ongoing reporting framework. It is reporting season, and the new Cocoa Life 2018 report from Mondelez International includes a commitment to source 100% of the cocoa for its chocolate brands via the Cocoa Life Sustainability Programme by 2025. Cocoa Life is designed to help create a more sustainable cocoa supply chain through increasing yields on existing farms and developing resilience in the farmer communities. A primary aim is to reduce deforestation rates. The new report demonstrates the programme's success in improving farm performance, increased capacity in growing communities to take control of their own development, and decrease expansion from existing farms into protected forests. Coca-Cola European Partners' new sustainability stakeholders report highlights progress on water impact and packaging. The business has cut water use by over 11% since 2010 and replenishes 141% of the water used when sourced from water-stressed areas. In 2018, 98% of packaging was recyclable and 28% of the content in PET bottles was recycled. The company's absolute greenhouse gas emissions across core business is down 50.6% since 2010. Innovation Forum's next events are the Chicago and London legs of our new Future of Food conference series. In Chicago on 22nd and 23rd of May, we'll be joined by experts from Danone, Mars, Campbell Soup, PepsiCo, Kellogg, Mondelez International, Bunge, Cargill, and many more. And in London on the 4th and 5th of June, helping to lead the discussion will be senior business leaders from the likes of Ferrero, Olam, AB InBev, Marks & Spencer, Syngenta, Unilever, Diageo, Waitrose, IKEA, and Nestle. Conference passes to both events are still available. Full details of how to attend are on the Innovation Forum website and in this week's newsletter. Interview time now. When he was in New York last week, my colleague Toby Webb met with Tonsi Whelan, Professor of Business and Society at the Stern School of Business and former President of the Rainforest Alliance.
Well, thanks for inviting me to your office here at lovely NYU, New York, where we wanted to talk about the work you've been doing setting up the Center for Responsible Business. So let's just talk about that work for the last few years. So you're a clinical professor of sustainable business. Tell us where that came from and what you've been doing for the last few years.
Well, as you know, Toby, before I came to Stern School of Business here at NYU, I ran Rainforest Alliance for 15 years. And I got very interested in the business case for sustainability, and we worked a lot with business. So I was invited to come to Stern to teach, and I pitched them on setting up a center for sustainable business. And I said I would raise money for it. So, of course, they couldn't turn me down. And so that's what I'm doing today. So the NYU Stern Center for Sustainable Business focuses on helping current and future business leaders embed sustainability core to their business strategy so they can drive innovation, they can drive operational efficiency, risk reduction, and of course, value to society. And as for what a clinical professor is, so a clinical professor is someone who doesn't have a PhD necessarily, but has actually been working in what they're teaching, and that's what I am.
I thought it meant that you had to be incredibly precise in everything you said. But, but it's good to see academia finally employing people who have worked out in the real world of business. I know it's a cheap shot, isn't it, academia? Yeah. But, you know, we do need more business experience in this, so that's great. So just on the sort of funding side, you make it sound so easy to go out and set something like this up. But I mean, where did the money come from? How do you kind of get this thing going?
Well, so I went to some donors. I went to Citibank, who I had had a long relationship with at Rainforest Alliance, and they agreed to give me $1 million over 2 years to get the center started. Then I got some funding from a Stern alum who I hadn't known previously but read about it, was really excited about it. And then I've been getting funds from foundations, from other Stern alums, from major donors. And also we do executive education courses where we get the proceeds from those. And we do some work with business where they support us for the work that we do for them. So a variety of different sources.
That's great. Congratulations. I mean, I'm familiar with the fact that in Europe, it's been a bit of a struggle for universities to sort of set these things up and make them sustainable. So it's great that you've managed to do that. One of the things we were talking about before we turned on the tape was about measurement and how it's a bit like the blind leading the blind when it comes to companies understanding how to measure their impacts. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're very interested in this at Innovation Forum. We have this annual conference that we do this year. It's on purpose and performance, and it's in June in London. We also do something similar with the Erb Institute in Michigan every October. While these measurements are improving, it still seems that companies are really struggling here. And what are your views, and what's the research that you've been doing in this space?
So we've been researching how to better capture the return on sustainability investment, or ROSI as we call it. Because as you know, there's a lot of studies that show a decent correlation between good ESG or sustainability performance and good financial performance. But it's only showing a correlation, not a causality, right? And the reason why it's not showing a causality is because when you go to the companies and look under the hood, so to speak, or the bonnet, as you say, they aren't actually tracking the return on their sustainability investments other than things like, you know, energy savings, right? Which is pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
So we began to look at that and developed this ROSI methodology that identifies 9 mediating factors that drive financial performance when you embed sustainability: innovation, operational efficiency, employee engagement, retention, supplier loyalty, risk mitigation, and a variety of other things. Now, all of those things can be driven by good management, right? So you can drive innovation in a variety of different ways. But what's interesting is that companies aren't recognizing yet that when you really have a robust sustainability strategy that is really core to your business strategy, it actually drives innovation and operational efficiency and all these things. And you can actually get a significant return. So we've been working with a number of different sectors, starting with commodities, food commodities, and agriculture, which we'll talk more about, and moving to the automotive sector, and also with the apparel sector and with the pharmaceutical sector, to help them better understand the financial return on investment. So just to give you an example from the automotive sector, which I think is fascinating. So we worked with Aston Martin, VW, and GM. We interviewed their senior executives to understand what are the key sustainability strategies. And then for each strategy, we broke it down into what are the practices they've put in place, and then how do you actually quantify and monetize those practices. So just to give you an example, waste management is a sustainability strategy for the automotive sector. They are now recycling their paint and solvents. As a result of that, they are purchasing less solvents. They no longer have to pay for the wastewater and solid waste disposal because they're recycling, and they actually have recycled product left over and they're selling that, so they have a revenue source. So they have three financial benefits from that one small action, plus obviously a significant environmental, positive environmental impact and health impact. And yet they've never put all those numbers together in one place, right? Another example is one automotive company. So in Europe, you have to, as an automotive company, you're responsible for end of life disposal of the cars, right? And so one company reused 2.5% of the materials from the cars and sold to recyclers 10% from the cars. And they made $100 million in doing that. But because they were seeing it as a compliance issue, they didn't do it in the United States because it's not required here. But they sell a lot more cars in the United States. So if they actually did that net, they would have had significant more income in the United States from the product. But because they were thinking it as a compliance issue, nobody was looking at the financial impact, they don't think about it that way. So it's a really interesting company. Accounting, I think, is no longer fit for purpose in many ways. It sort of, it was developed in a time when everybody was accounting for capital assets and not for intangibles like your IP, like your R&D, like your brand, and all, and where sustainability fits in. And so we really need to rework the whole corporate accounting system to actually track the financial benefit of all these different sustainability investments.
Wow. So it sounds like real progress is being made. What's the key to unlocking companies doing this themselves?
I think the key to unlocking companies using ROSI or something equivalent to assess the return on sustainability investment is for the CFO to understand that how much value is actually there. So for one of those automotive companies, it was 3.7% of annual earnings. That gets the CFO's attention, right? I think right now, most CFOs think, oh, this is a nice thing to do. Maybe it's some risk avoidance or it's a compliance thing. But they're not seeing it as something that is generating significant value for them to go in and actually change all of their systems. So it's a big deal to figure out how to go do this on an ongoing basis. I think that's one part of the problem. I think another part of the problem is that the boards of directors and the investors are not asking for that information. Increasingly, they're asking for the ESG metrics, but they're not asking for the financial impact of the ESG metrics. But I think they will. I think it's coming. And then also, the sustainability strategies are owned by many different players in the company, and the data is in many different places, right?
So nobody's responsible for pulling it together. But isn't the sustainability director responsible for that?
In theory, but the sustainability director generally is responsible for the ESG data, but they don't understand or know what the financial data should be, right? They don't know how, if the finance people don't know how to do this, we certainly can't expect the sustainability people to know how to do this. They don't even speak the language of the finance people. So that's another area, right, where we need to work on together is to strengthen both working together.
So you need a kind of head of innovation who understands all of those different aspects.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd think shareholders have the right to demand some level of disclosure about what company's doing on innovation in this space. But I guess that's coming down the track.
I think it will.
I hope.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. You mentioned also that there's some work relevant to this in the agriculture space. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah. So we had two projects that we've been working on there. The first was working with McDonald's and Carrefour, looking at beef in Brazil, and looking particularly at deforestation-free supply chain commitments. So the question was, looking at ranchers, two different groups of ranchers in Brazil, what kind of financial benefit was being generated for the ranchers, for the slaughterhouses, and for the retailers around both sustainable agriculture practices and deforestation-free commitments? Because the retailers were concerned about asking ranchers to do both deforestation-free and sustainable agriculture because they thought it might be too much work and too much expense for them. So what we found, interestingly, is that with the uptake of sustainable agriculture practices, ranchers saw an increase in profitability of 7 times, increase in productivity of 2.3 times. They went from 0 high quality beef to 70% high quality beef, which means you don't have to sell beef at a discount and you get a higher price for it. We saw 20% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions and a variety of other environmental benefits. We did not actually assign a price to that avoidance of greenhouse gas emissions because there really wasn't a market there for it, but in the future there could be money associated with that. Ultimately, we were talking about $29 million net present value over 10 years for these ranchers, which is 30% of their income. So a really significant financial benefit. And then we saw moving up the chain that when you had farmers that were really doing much better financially and producing better quality product, that you reduced operational reputational risk for the slaughterhouses and the retailers. You now had a better, higher quality product, so you could charge more for it. And so there were a whole series of benefits that we also then quantified and monetized for the other players in the value chain.
This all sounds a little bit too good to be true. What's the scale of this, and how is it being built out and built upon?
Well, so another example, Mars saw the work that we'd done and got interested because they have their livelihoods fund where they and their suppliers are putting money into this livelihoods fund that then is being distributed in the form of grants to NGOs who are working with farmers to improve their farming practices and the sustainability of their work. So Mars was interested in having a tool and a way to demonstrate to suppliers that there actually was financial benefit for them in actually putting money into this fund. So they had us go through and figure out what are the buckets of benefits of improved sustainability for these farmers that you would get after investing in this fund. Everything from a more stable professional supply chain to long-term contracts, and actually be able to put a price on that. So now Mars has a tool for every single commodity that they work in, where they can go plug in numbers with their suppliers and demonstrate to them, you know, what kind of financial return there is concretely on their investment with Mars in sustainability for the farmers. Another example of a company who's using it in a very different way is Pfizer, a pharmaceutical company, who's taking the ROSI methodology that we developed with us and building it into their environmental health and safety strategic planning so that as they plan and set targets, they can figure out what the ROSI is, the return on sustainability investment is with those, with that planning process. So I think there's a lot of uptake and interest. And then finally, we're now have recruited companies in the apparel sector with a project being funded by HSBC, where we have a large retailer, Eileen Fisher and Reformation, and a couple of other apparel companies who are going to do a similar ROSI analysis with us.
That's fascinating. We run an annual sustainable apparel and textiles conference, and the one we just ran in Amsterdam was a sellout event. We had 200 people, and the debate in apparel is really moving on at a pace of knots. I was amazed at how the maturity of conversation is evolving in that space. But just jumping back to the beef deforestation, you did an HBR piece on it, or a Harvard Business Review, which maybe we can link to in the podcast text. But what happens now with that? Because I mean, that's always the challenge, isn't it? That you do a great project, you demonstrate this, and then the company can't, you know, the CEO gets fired or leaves, and things move on, and then before you know it, everybody you work with is left. And sometimes I come across companies who don't even know they did amazing stuff 5 years ago because of the churn.
Yeah.
How do you feel like that project is moving on now, and where could it go?
Yeah, so I think this is a huge challenge, and we've experienced it actually in quite a few of these research projects. The positive thing is that we had Nature Conservancy as a partner in that project, and they actually set up for us to talk to not only their people, but also the beef producers. And so we sort of went out to a much wider audience with our findings. And I know that's been part of sort of their initiatives, you know, moving forward. What we learned from the work with McDonald's, however, is that we didn't, in that project, involve the C-suite from the beginning. So in our automotive sector, we actually did. So we had interviewed and engaged everybody, not the CEO, but all the other C-suite players in it. However, there has been some churn at some automotive companies. So that's been challenging. What my goal is to deal with that, really, in terms of dissemination and uptake, is what I find is that investors are very interested in this. So starting with PE firms, for example, who are trying to create more value in their companies, those that are interested in sustainability, because not all are, as you and I were talking about earlier, we see this as an opportunity for them to encourage and work with their portfolio companies to actually put in place ROSI. We really want to get this out, the message out, in a way that people start to see, wow, there's a lot of value being created. So even if I don't use exactly Stern's ROSI model, I'm going to start beginning to collect this information. So I think little by little, as we make this a topic that people understand, we really build it into the business school curriculum so students go out there with having learned about this, right? We'll make it part of the DNA. It's going to take 10 years. I mean, this is not, I'm in this for the long haul.
Yeah, it's about sort of institutionalizing the knowledge management without wanting to sound too overly technical. But in a sense, if the limits of shareholder capitalism mean the companies have all this churn, someone else has to maintain, build and drive incentives for that knowledge retention. So that could be TNC. It could be investors putting it as part of their ESG criteria, demanding to know about innovation, making sure companies don't go backwards, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Interesting. Just to finish off then, what's the next 5 years look like ideally for you? I think the work you're doing sounds fascinating and much needed. Where do you want to take it?
Well, I am very interested in how we, from a business school perch, can have a positive influence on the next phase of capitalism, because I believe that's where we're headed. I mean, the Milton Friedman Chicago School of Economics, shareholder primacy, short-termism, managed stock price capitalism is still going full force ahead, but is hugely problematic, and those problems are becoming clearer and clearer, right? So what is the solution? Where do we go? What does that look like? Is an area that I think doing this business case work, having people use ROSI is one element of it, but there's a lot more. You know, I think sustainability, for example, is a huge driver of innovation. All kinds of cool stuff are happening when you start to put on both a systems lens, a design thinking lens, and one where you're building in those environmental and social limitations or opportunities from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So Nike Flyknit sneaker is a perfect example, right? With Nike building sustainability into their innovation play and sort of saying, okay, we're trying to come up with a high performance sneaker that's really cool, but that also reduces waste, right? And they did it. And it's now a $1 billion plus business. So I think that's an area that I really want to study and learn more about. I've been following a lot of different areas. In actually, sustainable apparel is a big place for that, because there's innovations now around, I mean, dye is a huge problem. So there's bacteria generating dye that uses a tiny bit of water, right? There's lab-grown leather. There's dresses made out of milk. There's like all this fascinating, right?
I mean, I just did a podcast with a guy at our apparel conference. And by the way, we had all those conversations about, you know, reducing chemical use and the innovations which are taking hold. Sustainable socks. I did an interview with a guy. We're going to publish it soon. He sold 2 million plus pairs of sustainable socks.
Love it.
And he says the biggest barrier is getting people to understand that nylon is a good thing.
Interesting.
So the biggest barrier is a behavior change. It's a perception that you have to have cotton socks. You don't. In fact, cotton socks, in his view, are a terrible idea for all sorts of reasons.
Chemicals and stuff.
Yeah, and the whole life cycle impact is pretty difficult. So you're right, it's a really, really interesting area.
Yeah, really interesting area. And then the other area that we're working on is, and we have a couple of different areas, but another one that I'm very excited about is, how do we get financing to scale up the adoption of the UN Sustainable Development Goals at a municipal level? So we are now initiating, with the support of Goldman Sachs and PepsiCo, we just announced a project last week, an initiative where we're going to identify investable opportunities with investors and communities in New York City to move forward on making the city more resilient, more innovative around sustainability. You know, things like greening affordable housing and creating urban mobility, or creating vertical urban farms in food deserts in underserved areas, right?
Yeah.
So really excited about that as the next initiative.
Fantastic. Well, I'll come back next year. We can talk more about that. But as for now, Tonsi, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, Toby.
And listeners, if you're interested in more on these subjects, we hold our Purpose and Performance Conference in June in London. And again, we're here in October in the US in Detroit. And please check back to Innovation Forum's website for more information soon. And if you want to know more about Tonsi, Google NYU Stern Center for Responsible Business, and you can read more about the work they're doing there.
Don't forget, you can still get tickets to join Innovation Forum to debate the future of food in Chicago later this month and in London in June. And also coming up next month are our Positive Impact Conference and Sustainable Biofuels event. Full details available online. But that's all for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.